Today, we talk with two authors who go deep into our cultural histories to help us understand where we've come from and where we are through some darn good storytelling. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Elaine Kozlova has written a book about butter, and not just on how to make a good hollandaise sauce. Butter is one of our oldest foods, and she describes for us the wonder to the palate of cultured yak butter made in the old ways, along with the role butter has played spiritually, medicinally, and as an important food for thousands of years. We'll talk with Elaine in a minute. A little later on, we'll engage with Barbara Dowd Wright, whose deep family history inspired An Awakening Heart, a fictional retelling of the Moravian Brethren who settled this continent at a most formative time in our nation's history. And Barbara has just published An Irish Tale, inspired by her Irish roots on the other side of the family. It's a lyrical imagining of the young life of St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, and the pagan woman who loved and healed him. We go deep. It's a novel idea. Elaine Kozlova is a writer who specializes in stories about food history and gastronomic culture. She outdid herself with butter, a rich history. Her interest in cheese led her to the world of dairy, where she discovered the origins of butter and its amazing dimensions as food, as elements of religious practices, its functions medicinally, and its roles socially and nutritionally for thousands of years. And she throws in a couple of good recipes, too. Her butter quest took Elaine throughout the United States and France to Ireland, India, Bhutan, and Canada. Here is our conversation. Elaine Kozlova, welcome to Sonoma County. We're a great place of butter here.
Yes, indeed. Dairy farms.
And we're here to talk about your book, Butter, A Rich History. And for our listeners, they think, butter? A book on butter.
And a whole book.
A whole book, and it is not... You have recipes in it, and recipes we might be interested in, but you go deep and expose some things culturally, spiritually...
Gastronomically, right, yes.
All of the above, and really open it up. Why don't we start out by maybe you describing the best butter you've ever tasted, as you talk about in the book, in the Punjab region of northern India. And that might help take us full circle to some of the origins of butter.
Yes, indeed. Well, I will say that that is the most remarkable butter I've had to date. I'm still, you know, very interested in tasting butters. But I went to Punjab region specifically to witness water buffalo butter making, you know, the milk from water buffalo. That was always the traditional butter in India for centuries and centuries. Now, of course, cows have become acclimated through different genetics to the climate in India. So, and the cows produce more milk. So we're seeing, you know, that disappear from the culture of water buffalo butter making. So I really wanted to capture that as well as the technique, which is very unique to that region, because they take the water buffalo milk and they culture it overnight and make this super delicious yogurt. Water buffalo milk has twice as much fat as cow's milk. And so, you know, it just carries all this flavor. So to get to my experience, you know, I watch them then churn this delicious thick yogurt by hand using a system of ropes, which is also very unique to China. No one else does that in the world. Into butter, which took, you know, a good half hour, 40 minutes. And water buffalo milk butter is white. It looks kind of like lard. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect, but it was extraordinary. I mean, it was this butter where like the flavor just kept coming, and it was sweet and a little nutty and tangy, and it was just perfect, really delicious butter. I'm sure I'll never have it again, but it was very good. And there are many, many great butters in the world, but that really stands out, perhaps because it was such a surprise too.
And you come from a background of writing about food and being a pastry chef yourself.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that that's what drew you into this, diving deep into butter.
Yes. It was really the science and craft of butter that fascinated me first, because I started to see, beginning about 10 years ago, you know, how the butter market had all this breadth, you know, that didn't exist when I was growing up, you know, even in my 30s. So now we had all these imported butters from around the world, different cultured butters, high-fat butters, whey butter, goat butter, sheep butter. You know, I saw all this variety. And even within these different categories, there were nuances. So if you had a cultured butter from France, it wasn't like a cultured butter from California. And I really was astonished, because I knew that butter is essentially one ingredient. It's cream, you know. And so what was going on? What kind of manipulation, what factors allowed for all these nuances that were available to us? So that's where I dived in, you know, into the science and the craft. And that naturally led me down to, you know, through the history of butter. And it was at that point, actually, where I thought, this is a book. This, I can't believe it doesn't already exist. Because I was looking for a lot of answers that weren't out there.
And you do include some of the science behind how butter is created. But the book isn't heavy on that. Mm. So it informs the reader. But It was some of that deep cultural information that you expose that I think for most of us, we go to the store, we buy butter, we put it on our toast, we put it in the frying pan.
Yeah.
Or there's probably gradations of how we interact with butter, but it was some of those roots of butter from the very beginning of how maybe people discovered butter, but it really is one of the oldest foods, nutritional sources, medicinal sources, but there's even a spiritual element pulled in. And how surprising was all this to you? Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, you know, my original book proposal had 6 chapters, which grew to 10 because I kept, you know, finding more and more fascinating information about the cultural history of butter. And as you mentioned, you know, butter's metaphysical life, that was really astonishing to me, because many ancient cultures around the world, beginning with the Sumerians, 2500 BC, Vedic Aryans, the Druids, the Hindus, the Buddhists, they all had spiritual practices that involved the use of butter. Butter was a medium for them. And, you know, and so that was really fascinating to document, and also to see that some of them have survived, such as, for instance, Tibetan butter sculpting. That's very much alive and well, and that began around 600 CE. And if anything, it's just become more of a vibrant practice, you know, around the world you see it, because the practice of creating butter sculptures, which are called tormas, That is central to Tibetan Buddhist practice. You can't have a prayer festival. You can't set your intentions. You can't do many of their spiritual practices. You cannot do it unless you have tormas on your altar that represent certain deities. So that was a wonderful discovery, as was the fact that one of the world experts in this practice of butter sculpting in Tibet lived just 2 hours from me. That was a wonderful surprise. She's a Buddhist nun who lived nearby, I've discovered. Yeah, serendipity there.
You did travel all over the world, though, didn't you?
I did. As far as my advance for the book would take me, you know, I still would like to get to some other regions. I'm still quite fascinated with the, you know, cultural life of butter. But I wanted to go to India, again, as I said, to document that, the whole water buffalo butter culture, but also to Bhutan, where the herders have yaks in the mountains, as they have for more than 1,000 years. And so I knew the reputation of yak butter. It was supposedly a very funky butter. And, you know, I really wanted to just understand all that, particularly knowing that some of these cultures around butter making are disappearing. You know, it's just how long will it continue with globalization? And even in Bhutan, so I hiked up 13,000 feet with my husband to camp among these yak herders and really witness them milking the yak as they had for centuries, and taking that milk, putting it in a stream to cool it, you know, making butter then with it in a primitive wooden churn. Like, nothing has changed. It was like time travel. But at the same time, I learned that their children are now required to go to school down in the valley. And oftentimes when they go down to the valley to a boarding school, many of the kids don't want to come back. You know, they've become part of sort of modern society, and they don't want the isolation of the highlands anymore. So I'm glad I went. You know, it was personally just a culinary interest, but then I felt really glad at least I documented this, you know.
The pre-industrial ways of making butter. You just mentioned a term, cultured butter.
Yes.
And maybe you can describe that difference and what industrialization brought.
Yes. So before the mid-1800s, the only butter that existed in the world was cultured butter. There was no such thing as sweet cream butter. That really came on the scene with the development of the cream separator. So cultured butter is a butter that's derived from cream that has fermented slightly or even a lot. It could really be taken as far as you want and have a super tangy product. But essentially, you know, how butter making grew up was through the practice of, you know, collecting milk and letting the cream rise to the top of the milk, which took a good 16 to 24 hours, and then skimming off that cream and either putting it in a churn right away or collecting it till you had enough cream to make butter in, because the churns were quite big. So during that time when the milk was sitting and the cream was levitating essentially to the top, it would naturally ferment. There were lactic bacteria always around the dairy. You know, it's very rich in these particular kinds of bacteria, which are not harmful, by the way. They're good, healthy, normal bacteria. So they would go to work on the cream, slightly acidifying it, fermenting it, and actually giving it some complexity. So people, especially in Europe, really like the taste of cultured butter and have continued, you know, culturing their butter because that's what they prefer. But in the States, when the development of the cream separator came on board, again, this was the late 1880s, that really shifted everything because suddenly you didn't have to wait for the cream to rise. You could take the milk, separate the cream, you know, have the milk in another container, sell the milk, but take this cream and immediately churn it. And it became a new product, essentially, sweet cream butter. That's why we're still left with that label. To this day, many, many butter brands still say sweet cream on it to differentiate what used to be always cultured.
And likewise, if it says on a label, European style, that's cultured.
My understanding is that that means that it's a higher fat butter. That particular designation, like Land O'Lakes now has a European style butter. They're not culturing it; they're letting it keep. They're draining less of the buttermilk. So if you drain out more of the water, butter is 20% water and 80% fat, and that's the standard for a butter in this country. But in Europe, it's generally 82% butter fat, and so 18% water. And that 2% doesn't sound like a whole lot, but if you're making pastry, it really does make quite a difference. And now you can get 84% butters, even 86% butters. So it does matter if you're a baker.
And I think that some of us maybe have never experienced this rich diversity of flavor or noticed it much. Mm. And unless you're really,
really
focusing on that.
Right, it's true.
Yet it seems like there are more artisan butter makers that and artisan creameries that are putting out some of these products that, maybe we ought to indulge in.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to try a few side by side. That's when you really get to see the nuances. I mean, imagine if you were taking Pinot Noirs, for instance, you know, and a flight of Pinot Noirs. Think of it in terms of a flight of butters that you could try, because you really do need to taste them side by side to get the nuances. So I would recommend people do that. And, you know, it keeps pretty well. If you have a lot left over, you can put it in your freezer and use it for baking or something like that. Yeah, it's a really interesting time for butter. And I would encourage people to not just always grab the same brand. You know, it's great to have the supermarket butters. They're affordable. You know, they're very standardized. We're lucky our cookies always come out the same because the butter is so standardized. But there's a whole lot more to play with and experiment with out there. Yeah.
Well, reading the book encouraged me to spend a little bit more and try a new butter. And here in this region, we are very much advocates of consuming local products.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that's happening all over the country. But we live in an area where this is very easy for us to do. And you have you do describe butter tasting in the book just as if it were wine tasting. I want to get back to some of these cultural elements that I found interesting, that dairy maids, milk maids are, we now think, I can picture in my mind several paintings I've seen over time of rosy-cheeked maidens, milk maidens. And there was one point in the book where you said, woe the woman who didn't have a daughter.
Yes.
Because these people on the farm, these women, were the core of dairy production and butter making and commerce.
Yes.
And that went through a transition, in a gender transition of who was controlling that when industrialization came in. And so I wonder if you could talk about the role of women in this commerce, in this product and commerce and the transition.
Yeah, the revolution. Yes, it's interesting to note, first of all, that what my research discovered was it was pretty much taboo, almost universally, for men to have anything to do with the dairy arts, milking, butter making, cheese making. It was extraordinary that, you know, men, you know, who now control the industry so much, really, they were completely outside the dairy. It was a woman's domain because it was rooted in birthing and lactation and fertility, you know, sort of motherhood. So women had a monopoly on that. And because of it, they earned a certain, you know, status, a certain respect from the fact that they could take this liquid milk and turn it into all kinds of things, you know, including butter, but cheese as well. And men, you know, for the longest time, of course, had no idea how this was done. It was quite an enigma, and yet women could make it happen. So there was, you know, this sort of status and respect that women gained from being able to do this with milk, even more so than their many other chores. You know, of course, they made their own clothes and they were gardening. You know, they had so much work to do. But butter making was particular in that way because butter was so valuable. And it also allowed women, particularly women on farm women, not dairy maids who worked at manors, it's a different story. But, you know, the farm wives, they took great pride in their butter. That's why we had so many beautiful butter molds, their hand-carved butter molds. So they took pride in their butter, and they brought it to market. And, you know, this was part of their social life then because they were interacting in the community, and they get cash in hand, so they have a little independence. So it was quite a great, you know, good thing for women for the most part. And then, again, the cream separator came along, and that just revolutionized everything because I describe how, you know, butter left home at that point. Butter making left the farm, and it went into factories and creameries, never to really return until now. You know, now we're seeing this resurgence of farmstead butters, which has been so interesting. So, you know, women lost, in some ways, they lost some drudgery, certainly, some labor, but they also lost, you know, some real socioeconomic value in that transition to the factories, which again became dominated by men. But even the dairy manors, where, you know, men were in charge, women were still doing all the work. There's videos, even in the 1930s, of a whole team of dairy maids, each with their own churn, making butter. Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah.
Just another example, I think, of the lack of integration of women into advancing industry.
Right. Yeah, and women were thought to impede the progress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you had a different kind of model of needing truck drivers.
So. Yeah, very different system. And that happened, you know, within a generation.
Yes. And after literally thousands of years of a different model.
Yeah.
And that kind of coincides with looking at butter and heart disease and fats and that sort of thing that for many decades gave butter a bad rap and maybe even pointed us economically and certainly from a health perspective in a direction of eating other sorts of fats and foods and even other animal products like oleo. So maybe can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So margarine came on the scene in the late 1800s. Again, there was a lot of revolution in the 1800s between the cream separator, refrigeration, and then margarine shows up. It was invented by a French chemist who actually mixed beef fat with milk and salt and a little food coloring. So it actually bore no resemblance to what we know as margarine today. And I have to say, when it came on the scene, it was really well received because back in the day, there was quite a lot of bad butter on the market, especially in the cities. If you lived on a farm or you're in farm country, you had great butter no matter what your economic status. But in the urban centers, the wealthy had good butter and the poor had pretty bad butter. And not much choice. They weren't importing olive oil. They weren't making vegetable oils. You know, so what was your fat? And margarine shows up, and it's less perishable. It's more affordable. Apparently, it tasted okay. You know, it certainly tasted better than the rancid butter. So it really, right away, kind of took off and became a great competitor for butter. And that continued for 90 years. You know, and so initially, margarine, you know, had a practical value and a cooking value, but it was. By the 60s and 70s, it suddenly had this health food status that it drove butter kind of into the ground. It's amazing to see that in the 1900s, we went from eating 17 pounds of butter per person per year in the early part of the 1900s, and it plummeted to 4.5 pounds per person per year by the end of the century. And that had a lot, of course, to do with the anti-fat war, you know, that we've lived through now for the last 60 years. It's finally beginning to shift as we see the consequences of what that did to our diet and our health and our bodies. You know, we've made some progress against heart disease, but it's mostly because we've gotten so good at the plumbing around the heart, you know, the valves and the stents, and because smoking is, you know, so much less prevalent. Smoking's, you know, great cause of heart disease, you know, a very certified cause of heart disease. And so it wasn't, you know, our gains have had virtually nothing to do with our diets because, of course, we were eating trans fats, which were in the margarines, which only increased heart disease. You know, so it's a wonderful time to be talking about butter now because the science is so much more clear than it was 50 years ago.
that butter actually has a strong nutritional value for us.
It's particularly grass-fed butter. I would say that there is a difference. Remember, you know, in the early 1900s, when we're eating 17 pounds of butter per person per year, it was grass-fed butter. That was the model. There were not industrial butter, dairy farms at that point. And there is a difference in the micronutrients like conjugated linoleic acid, which is a wonderful disease fighter, vitamin K2. You know, the composition of saturated fat is different. There are saturated fats that are good. You know, they raise your HDLs. So, yeah, it's not a question of, oh, well, maybe butter won't hurt me. It actually can do you some good, particularly if it's grass-fed.
Well, this is a very rich book and a very rich history of butter. I'm talking with Elaine Kozrova. Thank you for this book that opens up a food that maybe some of us have taken for granted and maybe some of us just want more of.
Yes, thank you for coming. My pleasure. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
My conversation with gastronomic rock star Elaine Kozrova, and her book is Butter, A Rich History. We'll take a short break, and then we'll hear from Barbara Dowd Wright, who's just released An Irish Tale. Is a retelling of the legend of St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, before he was St. Patrick, just a shepherd boy, in love with the Celtic pagan who healed him. Now let's listen to singer-songwriter, banjo-playing Abigail Washburn from her album City of Refuge. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.
I got a mother. I got a father. Diamond lace and stark white collar. She looks good. He makes the dollars. I'm just free to do what I wanna. I gotta run. Run, run. Papa remembers the names with the faces. I can speak on the topic of religion. Just can't seem to make a clear decision. I gotta run, 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 run.
Tales are best told at night, says Barbara Dowd Wright in her just-released An Irish Tale. Barbara practiced for many years as a psychotherapist, a strong foundation for writing about people. However, it was her Moravian family diaries tracing back to pre-revolutionary times that inspired her first novel, An Awakening Heart, and her curiosity about her Irish roots that led in an entirely different direction in An Irish Tale set in 5th century Ireland. Here is our conversation. Barbara Dowd Wright, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you.
We're very happy to have you in to talk about your latest novel, An Irish Tale.
Indeed.
But I feel like I want to mention for our readers who might not be familiar, your first book, Jewish Renewal in America, is an anthology of interviews that you did. And then you followed that with a novel on Moravians in early America called An Awakening Heart.
Yes, I did.
And now this latest book, An Irish Tale. And I saw a lot of similarities between An Awakening Heart and An Irish tale. And before we get into the actual stories there, I wonder if we could talk about that, your own deep family history of genealogy inspired both of these books.
They did, absolutely. An Awakening Heart was my mother's family, and that was very, very well documented, easy to write. And then I felt bad because I thought, if you're Irish, you have maybe an oral history, maybe there's church history, but it doesn't really go back very hard. It's hard to find. And so what I thought I would do is to look around about the Dowds and see where they came from. And in the back of the book, of course, I describe how I found them on a porcelain mug at an Irish fair.
The other side of your family that has this very deep history that even you, it seems like you have family letters that are now in the library at Harvard University.
That's right.
So that is the source material that you were building upon for your novel. But not every family has that kind of written history.
It was an amazing thing. There were boxes and boxes and boxes at my great aunt's in Massachusetts. And when I was a little girl, she showed me these things. And I was 7. I really thought, I wasn't really very interested. But when she died, I realized that she had saved papers since the Revolutionary War, all primary source material, most of which were by women. The Schlesinger Library at Harvard is very interested in women's history. So I had these things all sent to my house, and they sat there for a long time. And when it came time for me to do my doctoral dissertation, I thought, gosh, I'd really like to look at these diaries that I had found of great-great-grandmother Sophia. And so I read every word of her diaries. She was 19 years old. She was very literate. She was a very, very interesting spiritual woman who really, in her Moravian church in 1830, wanted to be a minister. But at that time, the Moravians were not ordaining. They did early, and they do now, but at that time, they were not ordaining women. So Sophia being Sophia, she married the love of her life, Charles, who was, in fact, a Moravian minister. And she said in her diary, "If I cannot be a minister, I will serve God in my own way." So she was one feisty lady and gave birth to 6 children and then died of consumption. It was a happy life for her, but a hard one. And she died very, very young, of course. And so then her daughter carried on the tradition of saving letters and diaries, and it came down to my mom. So when I gathered all these things together, people said, I called Wellesley because there were a lot of stuff from Wellesley College where my grandmother was. And they said, "We want Wellesley." And the Moravians wanted the Moravians. Nobody wanted the whole collection. So I had a friend who had been at Harvard, and she said, "I know somebody in the library, and let's just call her up and see." And she said, "Oh, Barbara, this is an amazing find." So George and I hiked up 12 boxes of letters, diaries, memorabilia, and gave them to the archives there. And I was standing there sort of patting one of the boxes, and the archivist looked at me and she said, "You can come and visit them anytime."
So you didn't want to break up the collection.
I did not.
But what was it like to actually read those early artifacts, these early letters? I imagine that took some patience and transcription of handwriting that even might have been difficult to decipher. Did you do that transcription?
I did all of it, yeah. It was, the early ones were very easy to read. The handwriting was clear. The rag paper is better than the paper we have today. It was fantastic. When it got into the Civil War period, paper was very expensive. So people would write left to right down the page, then they'd turn the page and write over it. So once you get used to reading it, you can do it. I couldn't even see it now, but it was difficult. But, I have to say, beginning to look at these things, I felt I had to ask them, is this an intrusion on your privacy? I mean, I was reading diaries of very, very intimate thoughts. And you really almost have to ask permission. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful, wonderful graveyard in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania called God's Acre. And I used to go out there and just sit and walk around and think about these women. And they were, you know, I have their blood.
Yes, yes.
And I just wanted to make sure it was sort of okay to do this.
And so you took that foundation of these letters and created this novel called An Awakening Heart, that in fact you hear the reflection of these women who became brethren and settled in our country in Pennsylvania and then
right.
moving to North Carolina in a very hard period of time. Of where there was a lot of conflict, a lot of danger in the 1700s.
Well, the French and Indian War was going on, and the Moravians were hated by the English because they thought they were in league with the French, and the French thought they were in league with the Indians. And all parties were jealous because they worked so hard and they were prosperous. So taking their land and their buildings was always in the back of somebody's mind. So it was a difficult time. And they liked the Indians and they took care of the Indians. And that was another thing that was really very different on the American frontier. Very different.
Of readily making friendship
absolutely.
With the natives.
Absolutely.
Learning their language.
They learned their language and then they translated it into probably German mostly. Most of the old records are in German and Czech. And they took the Indian language and translated them, as I say, and tried to teach the people. They were there to evangelize. There was no doubt about that. But down in North Carolina, a little later on, they traveled with the Cherokee on the Trail of Tears. That's an interesting story in itself.
Maybe your next novel.
Another thing.
So you must have had to do a lot of ancillary research then to put this novel together.
Well, I did. It's easier now because so much is on the internet. But the archives hold, both in Germany and really all over the world, but certainly in Bethlehem, Lebenslaufen, which are the life stories. Each Moravian, before he or she dies, writes a life story. And if, of course, you can't write it at the end, if you're too sick, someone will write it for you. And so they have thousands, literally thousands, which give you a real glimpse into that whatever period of time it is. So I went through many of these life stories in looking at Christina, looking at Suzanne.
The characters in the book.
The characters in the book, sorry, yeah. And sort of marbled. They were written in a sort of a stock way. I mean, the point was that you would talk about how you really were not aware of God and how you became aware. But differently than some of the other Protestant denominations, I should say, they didn't talk a lot about sin. That was not the point. It was understanding yourself, opening yourself up, and then letting God in and trying to lead that life.
And the book is framed as the main character, Christina, what did you call it? The summing up of one's life before
Lebenslauf, life's story, really.
And it's framed as her life story, that way that she's telling it. And you hear her voice and then the voice of some of her intimates as well. And that's also a style you use in An Irish Tale. One is a hefty book, one is a slight volume, set it in different periods of history. Yet I found your style and voice as the author was very consistent in how you told the story. And I wondered if that was part of how you, as the author, immerse yourself in this material and it speaks.
Well, I think, I don't know how other people do this. I can hear them as I read. And I know one of the criticisms of An Awakening Heart was that it was so incredibly religious that the people were calling on Jesus every 2 minutes. But, you know, that's what they did. And I would have been untrue to them had I tried to write in a more modern way. It's not the way they talk. That is the way they talked. And I read so many of their letters and diaries. I just became part of that community. Then when I started doing an Irish tale, I had to think about my family did not speak with an Irish accent. My father didn't. His parents were not immigrants. It was his grandparents that were immigrants, probably during the Great Potato Famine in 1840. And they probably spoke with an accent. But I didn't really grow up with that accent around me. What I could pick up, though, I'm not sure how, was the rhythm of the language. And I wanted to get that rhythm in there. And if this book is put on tape, and it is going to be, I wanted an Irish actor to read it because it's a certain lyrical turn of phrase that isn't hard to do. I think I did it all right.
An Irish tale, it's a fictionalized interpretation of the early life of the man who became St. Patrick, but it's as much a story of the woman, Ciara,
right,
who it's told largely through her voice. And she is a Celtic pagan, and that is something that I feel the two books had also in common, was this heavy influence of nature.
Yes.
And of course, in an Irish tale, it is very much the core of who Ciara is. And I found that an interesting juxtaposition of the Christian and the pagan and what she brought to him.
I think you really picked up on something, and I'm so happy that you did. I was struck in reading a lot of the literature on pagan healing, food, ritual, particularly ritual and belief systems. And what struck me was how incredibly clever the early Christians were to incorporate all of this nature language and just tweak it a little bit to make it Christian. And I think that's how Maywin or Patrick was able to convert the people in Ireland so very, very well, as we know today. I mean, if you say Irish, you think Christian or Catholic, certainly. And I think that he did that because he had lived there for 6 years. He had listened to the language. He knew the language. So he could speak to them in their language the way the Moravians could speak to the Indians in their language, Native Americans, but they called them Indians, so I did too. So that's something similar. I had never thought about the similarities of these two books, really, until you told me. And I think it's a really interesting observation on your part, and a really good one. I think it's true. The language is different. The time is different. But there still is this, the Moravians, of course, in their German way, wrote down every tree, every bush, every tree. I mean, every blade of grass, practically. They had lists, amazing lists. The Irish pagans worshipped these things. And I was so pleased to be able to find in the hymn that most people know, St. Patrick's Breastplate, this one verse that spoke just of nature, really. That was very exciting to me because I thought he got it.
Pictures that we might, or representations of St. Patrick that we may see, have a shamrock and a clover
yeah.
that may have been his depiction of the Trinity using an element of nature.
Scholars argue about that. Uh-huh. It's just like saying that he got rid of the snakes. Well, there weren't any snakes anyway in Ireland. And some scholars say that it was ridiculous he didn't use this shamrock for the Trinity. But I don't really care. I really don't. I think it's a wonderful image, and it's certainly an image for the Irish, no matter what it's supposed to represent. And I wanted to make sure that it was in there. And, of course, this is the greenest land. If you fly in over Ireland, you think, oh, my gosh, every shade of green is down there. It's just an amazing place. And I loved it. And she, of course, is, I hope, the embodiment of nature. She's natural. She's part of it. She's wild.
And she's a healer.
And she is a healer, yes. Which her nurse saw in the beginning. She could have gone either way. Her brothers were wild. And yet, apparently, according to the genealogy, Fiacre's line did become Christian. Some of them didn't. And it gets a little muddy as to where I am in this line.
So now get us back to how you discovered this branch of your family, the Dowds.
That whole thing.
Yes, how you pursued this element of your family, whereas in The Awakening Heart, you had a lot of source material.
Tons of it, and there was none. But my dad was a storyteller, and he used to tell us lots and lots of stories about our ancestors and where they came from, and of course he made them up. And he would say, well, you know, we are related to the Berbers of North Africa. And they were the dark people that came to Ireland early on. And he said, that's who we are. And my sisters and I would laugh and laugh. We'd say, Daddy, you know, makes up the wildest things. I mean, we were Vikings, we were Basques, we were Berbers. I mean, come on. So years later, I was looking at an article somewhere that said that when they started doing DNA testing with all sorts of people and doing blood testing, they found indeed that many people on the west coast of Ireland around Sligo Mayo carried a gene from the Berbers. So I decided one night after my husband had died, I was restless, and I went to the computer, and there was some ancestry thing, and I decided to sign up. So I got my little kit, sent in my saliva, and came back, and it said, no surprises, Northern European for the most part, but 1% Berber. And I thought, oh, I wish Daddy were around so I could say yes. My sisters and I would have really, really, really laughed. So he was right. So I had nothing to go on. I had stories to go on to get back to your original question. And when George and I went to an Irish fair once, and we found this porcelain mug with the name O'Dowd on it, because that was the original name, and it was spelled D-U-B-H, I think, in Celtic. And it said the translation for the word Dowd, or the meaning, I should say, for the word Dowd is dark. It means black or dark, as does Chiara. And so it had a very short history on the back saying that the Dowds were related to Nile of the Nine Hostages. Well, it turns out that Nile of the Nine Hostages had trillions of ancestors. But when I looked up the genealogy, I found, in fact, that we really were a direct relation to this person. And I really didn't know anything about him. No one does. He is shrouded in mystery. Was he real? Probably. Probably. So I then read Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, wonderful book, and found that Niall of the Nine Hostages was the man or his family who stole this young boy from England, taking him to Ireland. And he was the young boy who became Patrick. So that story interested me, kind of, but in the beginning it really was the Niall and his family that interested me the most.
And you brought these together then of having Ciara, the female character in An Irish Tale, relating and falling in love with Maywin, who becomes St. Patrick. Where'd you get that notion to have it be a love story?
It had to be. It's a love story, I think, between the pagan and the Christian anyway. If you mix the natural world of pagans into Christianity, it's a loving thing. And it's really a very beautiful thing. So it would be natural that the two would fall in love, but know that they were separate. They couldn't be together. I think someplace I say that this is a shadow between them, and she knows that, and she knows that he has to leave. And he, of course, did come back. The question is, did he ever see her? We don't know. In fact, I don't really know if she's real. She might have been a fever dream of his and never existed at all. And that's what's fun about Irish stories, because you never really know what's real and what isn't.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank you for these two lovely books. And you do have a nonfiction book, Jewish Renewal in America. And maybe you could just leave us with what the experience of bringing your work to publication has been like, because writing the book is only part of the story, I think, for an author. What was your experience like of bringing these books to publication?
Briefly, the Jewish Renewal book had a publisher, and the publisher went out of business as I was interviewing, and I was had another woman with me, and she dropped out. So I finished, and I published it myself simply because I had promised these people they were going to be in a book, and they really wanted to explain their story of Jewish renewal. So that was a no-brainer. I did it with a small publisher. I think it's iUniverse. Then the second book, I really wanted people to know the Moravian story because it's a little-known story. It really should be told more when we think about it and teach American history. So I got to know in my research doing the diaries, people in Bethlehem, and one of the researchers there, one of the archivists, said, you know, you have to meet Pat McAndrew. She has a small publishing company here in Bethlehem. So Pat and I met and had coffee in the wonderful Moravian pastry shop, a Vienna pastry shop. Oh my gosh, you've never tasted anything so good in your whole life. And so we drank coffee and ate wonderful things. And she just read a little bit of it, and she said, I want it. I really want this, so I want to publish it. And so she did. So that was very easy. I didn't have to get an agent. I didn't have to do anything. And then Ken Rainier, who did the designing both in Awakening Art, he did the cover. And the cover is my darling granddaughter, Mary Washburn. And we dressed her up like that when she was down at Guilford College in North Carolina. And she was so sweet to do that. So that all was easy, easy. When I started the Irish book is primarily for my family. If people want to read it, I think that would be fine. But it was really a family book. So I had nothing in my head about trying to make a lot of copies or send it out a lot of places. Some people have read it and they really like it, so they've encouraged me to talk a little bit more about it than I normally would have. So that's what I'm doing now.
Well, that's kind of exciting when
it really is.
You haven't had to be preoccupied with the business of it as much, and the book is maybe getting its own momentum based on people reading it. What I felt about The Awakening Heart, as when we read many or encounter histories that we're unaware of, that a lot of place names that we might be familiar with really did have their origins in these early communities of Moravians.
Right.
And that not just with that community, but I think a lot of our own cultural heritage, lineage, no matter when our families came over to this country, is so easily lost.
I'm afraid of that now.
Yes.
Because you see all these diaries and letters were kept. But what happens? All we do now is text. That's how I get in touch with my grandchildren.
Do you keep a diary?
I don't. Charles and Sophia sit over my fireplace in their portraits, and every day they say, Barbara, write it down. And, of course, I don't. But, you know, I can be Christina. I can be Kiara, definitely. And so that's who I am, if somebody wants to know.
All right. Barbara Dowd Wright, thank you so much for visiting us today and bringing us these lovely books.
It was just wonderful being here, and so good of you to do this. I thank you.
My talk with Barbara Dowd Wright, her first novel is An Awakening Heart, and she has just published An Irish Tale. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Elaine Kozrova, and her book is Butter. We've had production assistance today from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Please subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org and listen anytime. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening today. It is a novel idea.